please. There's a bit of sun shining out there, but it's still a little bit on the cool side. I'm Joe Hollander, the chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here today. I am very pleased to welcome back one of our regular speakers, Dr. Peter Wood. Welcome, Peter, and I'll ask you to come forward and start your presentation.
Thanks
very much.
Kia ora tato. Good to see everybody. Welcome. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to talk a little bit about the New Zealand Wars, and specifically about Te Tika Waru, because probably behind other names like, Rewe Maniapoto, Honeheke, Wurumukini, and possibly at the other end for notoriety Te Kōti, Te Tika Waru has somewhat been forgotten, but he's possibly one of Māori's greatest generals of the era. He certainly he was a fighter. He had fought in the Taranaki Wars, so he had experience, but he was also a great military leader. So it's the closest, probably large-scale campaign to the Manawatū. If you wanted to, you could drive into the area of operations. You could be up there within 2 hours, spend a couple of hours having a look at it all, and then you'd be back in Palmerston North for dinner. So it's easily done, and so it's probably a good thing that if you wanted to follow up with us for a site visit or something. Anyway, I'm not going to talk too much about the individual battles or the detail of them. In the New Zealand Wars Study Centre, because they're primarily defence people, we'd often talk about the tactics, but then with other audiences in the military, we might talk about the leadership, the psychology. Sometimes we're looking at a campaign level or even a strategic level. So today we'll probably just look at Te Tika Waru's thinking at the kind of the campaign level, and how he ran a very short and successful campaign up until it wasn't successful right at the last minute. But anyway, more about that. In terms of the ground, and thank you for providing the pointer here, Te Nutu o Te Manu is Te Tika Waru's stronghold or base. He starts the operations at Turuturu Mokai, and they are bisected by the Waingoro River. As his operation becomes successful, he heads further down to Motorawa and Taurangi-Ika, and it's not actually too much distance to get to Whanganui, which was a bit of a worry for the settlers and the military. Just to put the campaign into context, the New Zealand Wars were preceded, opened with the Northern War, the Wellington and Hutt Valley campaign, and the Whanganui campaigns. These were small-scale campaigns, if you like, but probably the primary outcome of the Northern War was that it drew to New Zealand large numbers of imperial troops and ships, and with the ships came the cannon. So prior to that, New Zealand never had, other than Maori themselves, an armed force. But it was really the major outcome almost of Honeheke's war in the north was to draw the forces to New Zealand, which Governor Grey then used in Wellington and then in Whanganui. There was a period of relative peace, and then in the 60s we see the Taranaki and Waikato campaigns. And the thing there is that these are much larger scale, and so the number of imperial troops has gone up from hundreds to thousands, several thousand in fact, and not just infantry, but you've got artillery, engineers, logistics, river gunboats, so it's become quite sophisticated. And this is going to be very challenging for Māori, because the Imperials basically have a supply line of people and logistics that goes all the way back to London, albeit via Australia, but it's a very large force that they can ultimately draw upon, and this is going to be challenging for Māori, who are balancing up the need to be a warrior on the one hand, but also be a farmer or fisherman on the other hand, so that they can survive as well. And then, essentially, the other thing that's going on, especially during the Waikato and the southern Taranaki campaigns is that's the peak of the number of British soldiers. Their numbers are about to decline, but what we're seeing is the rise of colonial soldiers. And colonial soldiers are those soldiers who essentially have either, in some cases, been born in New Zealand, or perhaps have come over to New Zealand as a settler, or maybe came to New Zealand with the British Army, took their release, and then they are now essentially a New Zealander, and they've joined local colonial armed forces. And they go through various iterations. We've got militia on the one hand, made up of all males between the age of 18 and 60, who have to drill and do service. Often it's just static defences. They become volunteers, so Montenski or the Forest Rangers and other volunteer units form up. And then eventually they become the armed constabulary, which is a quasi-police and military force, probably more military than police, and that's really this armed constabulary-type organisation that's the primary force on the settler or the Pakeha side during Titokawaru's campaign. And by then, also, Titokawaru's time, all the British soldiers have left, apart from a couple of deserters, but more on that in a moment. And then the other thing to note is that, coincidentally, shortly after Titokawaru opens up with his campaign in South Taranaki, Te Kōti escapes from the Chatham Islands, where he's been held for 2 years as a prisoner, and he starts up his own totally unconnected campaign on the other side of the North Island. And what this does is it forces the colonial government to move the troops backwards and forwards between those two. Essentially, they've got a war on two fronts going on, although they're not actually connected. So, and that will have an effect as we go through the campaign. So I thought I'd have a look at the Māori Pā evolution initially, some of the key personalities in the campaign, the causes and the course of the war, flick through some of the battles, and then have a think about Titokawaru, the rangatira, the general, and the person, and maybe make some analysis from there. So Māori Pā design, traditionally we think of a tall hill or a cliff on the coast, a promontory, where a fortification has been built with high palisades. And, you know, often they would be defending against handheld weapons, other taiha, medi, that kind of thing. Some of them have been in existence for hundreds of years. And, you know, so crops are built outside it, and then the defenders, when they're going to come under siege or be attacked, will harvest all the crops, go inside the first line of palisades, and then if that's breached, they'll move up to the second line, perhaps move up to the third line if there is one, and try and withstand the siege. And some of these sieges can last for weeks. So that's the traditional thing. They're built to withstand the siege, and probably they need to be repaired from time to time. You know, the wooden palisades get damaged and break down. But you can see there, this model is from Nigel Ogle's museum, the Tawhiri Museum in Hawera, well worth a visit. And not just either for the Māori stuff, he's got a lot of material there, but he's built a scale model of the nearby Tauranga, the Turuturu Mokai Pā. He's also got a scale model of one of the battle sites too, but more on that later. So with the musket wars, and then leading into the New Zealand wars, Māori Pā design went through a significant evolution, and we call them the gunfighter type Pā. And when you look at them, you can see they're more rectangular in shape. They're no longer on a high hill, often they're just on a flat piece of ground. And they're designed, the straight lines are so that they can actually deliver a lot of musket fire through the palisades into the attackers beyond. And so now there's only a small outer palisade or palisades. Inside the palisade is a firing trench, and so essentially they are now perhaps waist, shoulder deep, or in this case I think you can see they're kneeling, but at least they're behind cover so they can generate a lot of fire. They also make good use of angles so that they can get crossfire in there as well. So these are quite deadly defended positions, but they're only designed for short-term occupation and use. So unlike the traditional Pā, these things can be built and they're somewhat expendable. And also the other main thing about Gunfight of Paris is usually an escape point or points. So if they believe they've reached a point where they could or should retire, or they're in danger of being cut off, they can, and often do, sneak out the back and make it to safety despite the best intentions to cut them off. And I think there where Mania Poto had a 2 tennis court sized par built at Tokohia in one night. It survived a whole day of bombardment the next day by British artillery, and then that night they snuck away. But they'd done their job, they got the British to fire first, which meant under Utu all the other tribes could now come in and support Wiramu Kingi. So, you know, quite good use of expendable terrain. Pa, like these ones in, well, this one at Rangiriri, the pas I showed previously were just relatively small and could be attacked. Some of the pa were much more extensive. They were basically barriers. And so this one at Rangiriri basically physically goes between Lake Waikato on one side and the Waikato River on the other, and it's a continuous barrier between the two. And the view there, what you can see looking along the top parapet, on the left you can see the redoubt, and that's it there. So you've got this kind of continuous barrier. The surprise of that one was probably the depth of the trench or ahead of the main parapet there. But that I showed these because when you see what Titikawaru's done, you'll understand his engineering genius and the thinking that's gone behind the kind of pa that he constructs. So we better get on with his campaign. Oh, and I should say, a lot of the designs we saw there were sketched and planned by an engineer, British engineer officer, Mould. And a lot of them been collected up into British parliamentary papers and sent back to the UK for analysis and stuff. But also those papers are available at the ECMC under Joe's collection there. So I thought I'd just turn to the key kind of personalities in the campaign. Firstly, Titikawaru himself. He's Ngā Ruahine Rangatira. His life is a mixture between peace and war, religion and warfare. He was born in 1823, so he's about at an age of 19. He's baptised as a Methodist. His baptismal name, Hohepa Otani, or Joseph Orton. He's had combat experience in the Taranaki campaign, and that's probably where he learned or observed some of the engineering. He did lose the sight of his right eye from a glancing blow from either a bullet or possibly a shell splinter, others would say. So he was at least perhaps incapacitated in that respect, but it certainly didn't stop the top half there in terms of his thinking. He got drawn into the Paimarini religion and then quickly became the leader of it when the Haumini died. And he then blended the Paimarini with his Methodist upbringing, you know, and also with his own thoughts around tribal or traditional religion of the Māori. So his stronghold was this village of Tenutu Otamanu. The two Pākehā protagonists, and it alternates between one and the other, they have similar sorts of backgrounds, if you like. Thomas MacDonnell, or Fighting Mac, he's really a kind of a farmer, gold prospector turned soldier, but he's very fluent in Te Reo, so he can converse a lot with the Māori, understand what's going on. He was commissioned into the Colonial Defence Force, this nascent New Zealand Defence Force, and he was at Paparata, Rangiofia, and Haereni in the Waikato campaign. And then in June 1866, he takes command of the Pātia military district, and his job is to support the surveyors that are moving into the South Taranaki to survey the land ready for occupation by settlers. He's a very ruthless leader and develops a reputation for this with both settlers and Pākehās and, of course, the Māori as well. And he's been farming confiscated land in and around Pātia prior to the hostilities. And on the other side is General George Whitmore, then Colonel. He served as a young officer in South Africa in the mid-1800s, the Boer Wars, the Kaffir Wars. He showed military talent, was often mentioned in dispatches. He served in the Crimea, and then later on he commanded a Turkish irregular cavalry, the Bashi Bazooks, if you've ever heard that name. So he was a very talented soldier. He signs up to be General Cameron's military secretary. They arrive in New Zealand. The Taranaki campaign is turned off, so they both offer their resignation. General Cameron's is not accepted, but Whitmore's is, so he suddenly finds himself without a job. He settles in New Zealand, takes up farming on the, in the Hawke's Bay, but then he signs up as a as an officer, and he's part of. He becomes a commandant of the Armed Constabulary. He's also on the Legislative Council, so he's also a mixed soldier and politician. And these two, McDonnell and Whitmore, will alternate during the talk as being the leader of the colonial forces at the time. And just some of the other faces in there, a little bit different. The first one is Kimball Bent. He's a deserter from the 57th Regiment. He's actually, I think, an American rather than a Brit, but and that's how probably Chitakawaru decides he can stay alive. But he knows how to handle weapons and ammunition, so he's a valuable resource as an armourer for Chitakawaru to repair weapons. But he's also quite a confidant of Chitakawaru, and I think he's treated by him as almost like a grandson. Different again, Gustavus von Temsky, Prussian, former member of the Forest Rangers, Armed Constabulary, and nicknamed Manurau, Many Birds, by the Māori. And he's with the Armed Constabulary during the attack on Te Nutu Otamanu, and he leads, slowly, the rescue of the attack at Turuturu Mokai. And then finally, just mentioning Te Kōti, he's on the east coast fighting his own war, having escaped from the Chatham Islands, and it's his war that draws the colonial forces between the west and the east flanks from time to time. And when they're on the east flank, that gives Titikawaru the room to push down further to Whanganui because there's less resistance. The road to war. Paimariri has emerged as a religion, as a way, probably that's religion sometimes does. A military force doesn't work. Maybe you will try another path to motivate people and make them believe or support a future. Chitakawaru, as I mentioned earlier, he assumes leadership, and he's responding to the bush scouring methods started by General Chute, the last British general, and followed up by McDonnell. So essentially, rather than attacking Māori Pā, they go after the villages, they burn all the crops, release all the cattle that they can find, trash the place, and essentially they're forcing Māori back into the hills and away from their land because they're being starved out, and then the surveyors can move in and divide up the land for settlement. Titikawaru establishes Te Nutu Otamanu as his stronghold and decides that he's going to make that the target for the big attack, and thinks far enough forward that he relocates a lot of his people, crops and all that sort of thing, to other villages that are away from Te Nutu Otamanu so they don't get destroyed during the attacks that he's going to provoke. McDonnell takes command of the Pātia Field Force, and he his job is to basically support the survey. Māori resistance takes the form of ambushes and small attacks, and you know we see a slow transition towards war, if you like. Titikawaru, though, doesn't immediately go to war. We often give Governor Gray the credit for having a peace strategy as well as a war strategy. He certainly did in Wellington, and he did in the Waikato. And I think maybe that's what this is here. Certainly in 1867, the year of the lamb, or the year of the daughters, as Te Tika Waru characterised it. He led a peace hikoi all the way down from Te Nutu Aotearoa, all the way down towards Whanganui, and then up the Whanganui River to Piperiki. And at that time, he and many of his supporters, it was a peaceful sort of march. But in the background, while all this was going on, the settlers and the government were still carving up the land behind them. So any kind of peace approach that he was trying to advance was being basically undermined by stuff going on there. However, the colonists assumed that the war was over because Te Tika Waru was talking about peace, and many of the military elements were basically stood down, so they weren't in a good state of readiness. Here's a newspaper article that appeared at the time around the hikoi, and so they go to Turuturu Mokai. So actually, Te Tika Waru has already been to what will be the first of his targets, and they talk about them being there and being in the area, about 150 of them along the way. So perhaps he's also running a peace strategy and using what he learns over that time to prepare himself for the coming conflict. 1868, though, things change. So there's a marked uptick here. It starts with muru, which is kind of like plunder, but without bloodshed. And eventually, though, Te Tika Waru orders, or at least sanctions, the killing of a number of soldiers and settlers. And then, in response, MacDonald is authorised to raise a force to operate against Te Tika Waru. So that it's going to take time. And Te Tika Waru knows this, so he obviously doesn't want the constabulary to get so strong. He's got to try and cause them to come and attack him while they're still at their weakest point in terms of numbers. Interestingly, this is a translation of a letter that Te Tika Waru left to be discovered, and I think just read out some of the words, you know, here. I have begun to eat human flesh, and my throat constantly craves for the flesh of the human. I shall not die. I shall not die. When death itself is dead, I shall be alive. Now, Te Tika Waru himself didn't actually eat human flesh, but he certainly threatened it, and he allowed some of his warriors to do that. And we'll talk about why that was so. But part of the wording there is designed scare tactics to put off the surveyors and the soldiers and the settlers. So he's using a kind of a psychological warfare here, if you like. What's his intention behind all of this? Really, he wants to stop the land being confiscated and occupied by Pakeha. So he's got to have a concept of operations, so we in the military call that a CONOPS. So to prevent further bush scouring and land loss by drawing colonial soldiers into a battle on ground of his own choosing. So what he's trying to do is work out a place, and it's Te Nutu Aotearoa, where if he can get the British to attack him there, or the colonists to attack him there, he hopes to do them enough damage to limit their ability to do the bush scouring and protect the surveyors. He's going to do this in a number of steps. There's reconnaissance, there's provocation, so that's the Battle of Turuturu Mokai, and then from provocation, that should draw the armed constabulary to attack him at Te Nutu Aotearoa. I should point out that he hadn't planned the latter movements down towards Motoroa and Turangika. That space was provided, a lot of it, because of Tukoti operating on the east coast. So Turuturu Mokai was a small armed constabulary redoubt. It was not well prepared, but it was isolated, and it had actually been sighted by Governor Gray some years earlier. Gray was a former soldier, probably thought he had an eye for the ground. What he didn't realise was that there was actually slightly higher ground beyond it, and that enabled the Maori sharpshooters to fire over the top of the redoubt walls, and they killed a number of the soldiers who were actually inside the redoubt, so it didn't really protect them at all. There were 22 defenders, and they were attacked by 60 warriors, all specially selected, and just about the entire force that he had, but all specially selected by Te Tuku Waru. And they included one of the deserters, a guy called Kane, who deserted and wanted to attack his fellow former soldiers who were now defending the redoubt. But the point there, I think, is that Te Tuku Waru refused to allow Kimball Bent to take part in the attack, probably because he didn't want Kimball Bent to be killed and lost to his cause and the skills that he had. Anyway, the attack is occurs in the dawn, and the outcome is pretty conclusive. Not only is the commander of the outpost killed, but so are 9 other of his soldiers, and 6 more are wounded. So it's a fairly conclusive victory on the part of the warriors. Te Tuku Waru has made it clear to his warriors, though, that they're not to get into a pitched battle, because he can't afford to lose any of them, because he's got so few warriors himself. The aim here is to kill as many of the defenders as you can for the least number of casualties yourself, so that will draw the armed constabulary of Macdonnell for into Tenutu Otamanu. And in fact, in the end, in a very showman-like sort of way, Macdonnell sort of draws a sword out and tells one of his officers, you know, I shall have revenge for this. So, no, clearly, hook, line and sinker, Te Tuku Waru has got Macdonnell drawn in to the trap. So good is the trap that actually Macdonnell has 3 attempts at attacking Tenutu Otamanu. First 2 are unsuccessful. The first attempt with 300 troops is heavy rain, problems guiding, finding the location in a very tall rata forest, and so the attack is aborted. The second attempt is also not successful, although they find Tenutu Otamanu. It just so happens that most of the defenders are away. And so whilst they get into the pa, and they burn some of the whareas, they capture some of the weapons, they're not able to engage with the warriors, Te Tuku Waru's warriors. But then when other warriors come in to join the fight, because they hear the shooting, then Macdonnell's force retires under pressure with 4 dead and 8 wounded. So it's kind of inconclusive. Neither side has really struck the blow they thought they wanted. But the third attempt is more decisive. Macdonnell leads with a force of 300 men. They quickly become disoriented, and they're coming in now from the north towards Tenutu Otamanu. The lead elements, the Māori, engage some Māori that they see. The shots are heard by Te Tuku Waru. He knows now the attack is coming from the north, so he positions his warriors in such a way that he's got 20 men with him in the pa, and about 40 others are now deployed to various positions forward of the pa area itself, the palisaded area. Macdonnell's force comes under fire from 3 sides. There are many casualties. Macdonnell is undecided about what to do. Eventually he orders a withdrawal, and Von Temsky is shot dead whilst awaiting orders. The force withdraws in a disorganised fashion, followed up by Te Tuku Waru's forces, and the casualties are 24 killed, 26 wounded, so about 50 of the 350 people involved in the operation are killed. So it's a heavy defeat for Macdonnell. And perhaps just why, and this is coming back to the PA design. If you look at that photo, this is painting. The painting shows the death of Von Temsky. It's quite a well-known one. But if you look at it, in the blue, that's the palisading, if you like, of the pa. But it's really the green area. So what Te Tuku Waru has done is he's pre-prepared fighting pits forward, camouflaged them, and he's got firing platforms under the trees with some of the warriors up there, and he's probably got them pretty much all around. But because he knows the attack is coming in from the north, he basically puts most of his warriors forward and just leaves a small group back. So as the attackers are coming forward, assuming that the Māori will be inside and behind the palisading, they get a big surprise when the firing opens up above them, below them, around the sides of them. That creates a lot of confusion. I mean, jungle warfare is like that even in the modern era. And for these soldiers who are not well experienced in jungle fighting, it would have been a terrible experience to have firing all over the place and people dropping, and you don't even know really where it's coming from. And so you ended up with withdrawal and heavy casualties. The next outcomes from Te Nuitu o Te Manu included government forces basically disintegrated. Many kūpapa Māori returned back to Whanganui. They left the fight. Von Kemsky's armed constabulary division mutinies, so that's out of the picture. And not only is Von Kemsky dead, but his forces have mutinied, and McDonnell resigns to be replaced by Whitmore, who learns that Te Tikawaru has established a new position at Motorawa. Because of his success at Te Nuitu o Te Manu, Te Tikawaru's force is now up in the figures of about 150 to 200 warriors, and Whitmore's got about 500. The defences you see there are just some of the linear with a slight bend, sort of looks like a screen or a palisade. It's about 100 metres long, 3 metre high loose palisading in that concave shape. A long trench behind the palisade. We talked about getting cover behind there and firing through the palisades. But more importantly, there are 3 towers, the circular things there. These are very tall, and it enables the warriors to be in protected cover, and they can actually fire pretty much 360 degrees around there. Te Tikawaru knows an attack's coming. He's got his own scouts and spies. Whitmore thinks that they can get close enough through that belt of bush there to launch a frontal assault. That's quickly detected, and the storming party of 50 armed constabulary from the front, they're allowed to get within about 10 metres of the front of the palisade, when all of a sudden, all along the front, and many of them are dropped to that first fusillade. Major Kemper, brings his kūpapa Māori, tries to get around the right-hand side, but is unable to properly. In the end, Whitmore withdraws the force, which is pursued. He's lost 20 dead, another 20 wounded. So about 40 people out of the 500 involved are actually casualties. So it was a tremendous victory for Te Tikawaru, because actually the palisading gives the impression that the defences are incomplete, that it's possible to get around the left or the right-hand flank. And also, quite possibly, they thought that the main defence was up at the pa up in the background, Okatuku, which had already been attacked previously at a different time. So, all in all, it was quite a different defence from that mounted at Te Nuitu o Te Manu, but equally as devastating. As a result of this defeat, Whitmore withdraws his forces further east towards Whanganui and establishes a base near Nukumaru. And he offers his resignation, not accepted. But while Whitmore is then drawn off to the east coast to fight Te Kōti, Te Tikawaru moves east himself and sets up a pā at Taurangiika. So on the east coast, Te Kōti is at large. He's undertaken what's commonly known as the Matawhero Massacre. Some 50 Māori and Pākehā men, women and children are basically slaughtered in a dawn raid that can't be left unanswered. So Whitmore and a lot of the European forces move to the east coast, and that provides enough room for Te Tuku to then essentially move further down towards Whanganui. After the siege of Natapa, where Te Kōti escapes, Whitmore brings the forces back to the west, and then very quickly he turns his mind to attacking the defences at Tarangika. Now this part is unlike anything else that Te Tuku has designed. Each of the four concave sides has got a tower at the end. It's what the concave sides do. Now, if you were to attack from a particular direction, what happens is that you can be fired on not just from the front, but from the left and the right flank, so it's actually quite ingenious. Moreover, double level up here means that in all of these, rather than just one person, you've got two people, so you've got double the amount of firepower coming at you. So it was a very formidable defensive work. It was a labyrinth of trenches and bunkers, double layered, as I said, so twice the firepower. And, you know, there'd be a real commander's dilemma for the likes of Whitmore, you know, where to, which direction do I attack from? A terrible thing to have to try and undertake. So it's about 140 metres across, so quite a large thing, almost like a couple of football fields. So very very strong defences. Whitmore plans to launch 800 armed constabulary plus a couple of hundred kupapa under Major Kemp, so about 1,000 he's going to put against this defence here. On the 1st of February, he positions a force nearby and commences bombardment with cohorn mortars, little mortars, at least lob a bomb over the other side to try and do some damage. But when they form up to do the attack the next morning, they discover that overnight the defenders have disappeared. And so the power is able to be taken without any casualties at all, which is just as well for the attackers, because they would have lost a lot otherwise. So there's a lot of conjecture as to why the pa was vacated. Whitmore liked to think it was because the Maori were fearful of the attack, which I don't think they were. They also put it down to perhaps a lack of ammunition, of which there was not. The most credible reason seems to be that, and it's come from Kimball Bent, but it seems to be that Te Tuku Wairau was having an affair with one of the other rangatiras that was discovered, and then basically overnight, mana gone and everybody just left the pa. And having vacated the pa for a while anyway, Te Tuku Wairau was then pursued pretty much back to Taranaki and inland from Waitara now, so just east of New Plymouth, up in a valley there. He remained there for a good long time. Then being left alone, and finally he went back to his pacifist kind of ways, and he was involved at Parihaka, where I know we talk about the two prophets there, two Maori guys, but he was probably number three, back to the pacifist thing. And the sketches that you see of him, that they're actually him at court before he gets jailed several times for pacifist way of preventing the settlers from getting land. So, what do we make of Te Tuku Wairau? We would break it down in the military, this kind of thing, into this fighting power model. But essentially, it's what was the person thinking? How were they thinking? How did they get people to fight for them? How do you make 60 into nearly 1,000? And what are the means that you have at your disposal? So I'll just go through them quickly. He certainly outfought the colonials. He was able to really think about what he wanted to achieve and play the long game. He made use of fear and terror to try and persuade settlers and surveyors. He was very innovative. If you think back to the different pa that he built, they were all different. Whereas, say, in the Waikato campaign, they were all pretty much one of the theme barriers between rivers and creeks or whatever. His one's all different. They were tactical ploys designed, you know, false target, I'll attack that par palisade at the back of Tumutu Otamano, but everybody's in front of you. I'll attack that incomplete Motoroa, only to find that they're firing at you from very short range, and when you try to go around the flanks, those towers give them the ability to fire around to the flanks and rear. He's certainly willing to take the offensive. He was fearless, but he also directed rather than led operations. So he was present at Tumutu Otamano with the 20 in reserve, but more often than not, especially like Turuturu Mokai, he'd specifically select certain warriors for the ceremony and everything else, so their special group, he would give them their orders, but then he would leave them to go away and conduct the operation. How do you get people to fight? You know, certainly he had a lot of mana himself. He was a rangatira. He was an outside candidate even for the first Māori king. He used paimariri and modified it, so there was that kind of religious motivation built in there. He was charismatic. His strong, deep voice was apparently a defining feature. He wasn't necessarily a giant of a man as Europeans might have expected from him, but he certainly was able to motivate people, persuasive speaker, possibly a bit of a showman, lots of ceremonies like the selection of warriors to fight. He allowed cannibalism, so that ceremony where the heart of the first victim or the first of the enemy to be killed was cut out, flame applied, and then they watched the direction of the smoke to determine whether it was favourable or unfavourable in terms of the attack. He allowed that and other things to go on as well. And as a result, he got from some 60 people, mainly of his own iwi, up to about 1,000 from the neighbouring ones, including some even from as far afield as the Waikato. But it works the other way. As soon as he'd lost his mana at Taurangika, of course, his force basically dissipated and he lost it pretty much overnight. And then what about the physical means to bring to the fight when you've only got 60 warriors? So he knows it was small numbers. He can't wage a conventional type war. He's got to be more innovative. And also he uses success that he gains to draw in more warriors. So, you know, previous slide shows you. Attacks as ambushes or raids rather than getting fully committed and trying to limit the number of casualties that he thinks. So he's trying to... He has to keep the numbers of warriors, and this is where Kimball Bent comes in terms of repairing weapons and stuff like that. And then he uses the forested areas to confuse and break up the opposition. So the hundreds of armed constabulary say that McDonnell has coming at Tumutu Otamano. Their strength as a group is whittled away by the fact that they're separated in the bush, in the forest, and they are fearful also of the nature of the fighting there, so he's really reduced their strength to a point where, having received casualties, they then withdraw. So that's how he sort of managed to be so successful. So James Billich assessed Te Tika Waru as New Zealand's greatest Māori general, and I tend to agree. He was certainly his tribe's greatest strength, but also probably their greatest weakness, and that once he'd gone, there was no one to replace him and continue. So really his campaign failed, ultimately, through that loss of mana, but also because he was the single point of failure there. He was still a shadowy figure who combined religion, military knowledge, and, if you like, even theatre to convince his warriors to follow him. He outthought, and I think outfought, his opponents. And then at the end of the day, he reverted back to almost where he'd begun by following a path of peace. And he was a prominent member of the Parihaka community, although those other two, Te Rongomai, and that are more remembered than he really is. So again, he's been largely all forgotten about in that. But he was a driving force in the Parihaka movement. I just wanted to say a little bit about the sources. Always tend to go initially with James Cowan, but also I think James Billich is probably written extremely well about Te Tika Waru. Not only are there great diagrams and the like, but there's some excellent explanations and a lot of the background to why Te Tika Waru was operating the way that he was. Fiction, or if you like, faction, blending of facts and fiction. Two books. Dave is here. He's written a great one, The Last Rangatira, and Dave's shows you the battle, gives it to you pretty much from the perspective of a settler who's joined a volunteer or militia type unit, so you're getting a perspective there, but also with his own experience, you understand jungle warfare, tactics, leadership and morale, so there's a lot to be learned out of that. Whereas Maurice Shadbolt's novel is looking at Te Tika Waru, but from Kimball Bent's perspective. So that also is another interesting read, which really engages you in the story and brings the campaign to life, as they both do, with more kind of mental imagery than perhaps Cowan or Belich manage. If I could also recommend a couple of museums, the Tawhiti Museum there has a great diorama of the Te Nuutu o Te Manu redoubt under construction, the redoubt being constructed rather than the model. He has a great story around Kimball Bent, and he's also produced a great model of the traditional Turitu Mokai Pa, so it's well worth a visit there, quite apart from the cafe and everything else that he's got there and the other things on display. But also the engineer called Memorial there has got a lot of stuff to do, well, it holds the records anyway for a lot of the par design, so that's quite interesting as well. So basically with that, I'm more than happy to take questions or discussion, and Dave, you're more than happy if you want to add in any points or answer any questions on my behalf. So there you go.
Questions? Dave, do you want to make a comment before you go? Make a comment.
Thank you very much. I don't want to take over
the computer. No, not at all. You are an expert now.
I'm about
that. Just give me a chance to do a count. Carry on.
I have a military background, obviously. I spent 23 years in the military and always had an absolute fascination with military history. And what better history than the history of our own country and New Zealand wars? So I got involved in it, and I was going to write a book, a novel, fiction, but based on history, on the facts. One novel, I thought I could get that out of the Taranaki Wars. I ended up writing three. There's just so much went on, so close to it. Just fascinating. And this guy here, Te Tika Waru, he almost made it. He almost did. Yeah. In fact, if the Maori had stuck together, if they'd all combined, I reckon they'd have kicked the Pākehā out. But they didn't. They fought against one another all the time. And as Peter's mentioned, there was a guy called Major Kemp, who was a Whanganui Maori, and he, right throughout the New Zealand Wars, he fought for the Pākehā side. He defended Whanganui very fiercely. And if it wasn't for guys like that, and another guy on the west coast, east coast, I can't remember his name now, it doesn't matter, Ropata. Those guys were real warriors, and they gathered big heaps of warriors together and fought on the Pākehā side because they hated the other guys. If they hadn't done that, we could have been in some trouble. We wouldn't be sitting here listening to Peter. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Peter,
I'm interested in cannibalism. Just because it was so foreign to Europeans for so long prior to coming here, and what was the New Zealand lethal attitude to Maori who they knew were guilty of cannibalism, and this guy admitted to it and said how much he enjoyed it. Did that influence how they were treated when they were captured?
Well, there was a general horror at it, although probably at the start of the New Zealand Wars, the practice had all but disappeared. And the reason that it all but disappeared was that many Maori, particularly in the far north, and then it slowly went further and further south, they converted to Christianity. And the idea that killing was actually murder, and that would therefore mean Utu, that almost endless cycle of revenge could be put aside. That actually convinced a lot of Māori that the laws that were coming, not just the religious thou shalt not kill, but the British law around murder, should be were good reasons to go with Pākehā law at least. As to the legal status, as far as I'm aware, they never tried anybody, well, I think other than the Vaultner case, they never really tried people for it. And so, for instance, Tita Kawaru was eventually pardoned, Te Kōti, and we might do a talk about him next year. He was also pardoned, and so I think they just kind of left the thing behind. There was really no legal follow-up at all, but there was horror and fear once the practice was reinvigorated by Paumarini and then eventually allowed to continue on under the Tita Kawaru. But of course, you know, Pākehā got back. They put a bounty after Tita Kawaru, his forces dispersed, they put a bounty on the head of Rangatira, £10, and others, £5. And guess what? A lot of Māori prisoners were decapitated and brought back, so not quite getting to cannibalism, but I think on both sides there was some fairly nasty stuff going on that today we wouldn't uphold, and there would definitely be legal consequences there. Okay. Yeah.
What would victory have looked like for Tita Kawaru, and was it achievable?
Well, actually, I think he almost got more than he wanted. Victory for him would have been, because he'd always tried, in that period, the year of the lamb, the year of the daughters, what he was trying to say is, look, the Pākehā are here, why don't we let them settle on some of our land and we'll keep our others? So for him, it was kind of like a mixed, okay, they're here, and in numbers, let's give away some of our land and let's keep some of our other. But while he was doing all this and making agreements with some of the other tribes, the Pākehā behind him were actually going through and surveying. So I think initially it was that kind of mixed model. They retain some and settlers get some of the other. Because even once he'd been pardoned, he actually started up a pretty successful grass seed business back in his own there. And apparently even though the Pākehā got the land for free, they paid a lot for the grass. So, you know, I think he tried to have a model where he could live with it, and that's probably reflected in Parihaka, where there was that slow resistance to settlement, trying to work out a way where, you know, both sides potentially could live with a result.
But would he have achieved that, or were the colonial colonising forces and pressures from the population?
No, I think
the population too big?
Yeah. I don't think. Eventually, it would have been undone, no matter what he did. And it, you know, it got undone because of Turangika. But no, there were going to be too many settlers, and indeed, the government of the day wanted the money from the sale of land because they needed to pay for their wars and their soldiers, etc., etc., etc. So there were other economic reasons in the background where they needed the land more than they needed perhaps peace with Tita Kawaru. So I don't think ultimately it would have succeeded.
Peter, my question is, how on earth did the Māori get their arms and ammunition?
Yeah, okay.
Oh, hang on a minute. No, no, don't steal this thunder because...
No, no, I can...
Next month's presentation.
Oh, yeah.
But no, different.
Yeah, so right from first contact with Europeans, where a lot of it was whalers and sealers, or other just generally traders, muskets and gunpowder had been the currency. So if you wanted kauri trees or spars for your ships, flax for rope, or you just wanted provisions, pork, potatoes, often the price for that was muskets and gunpowder. So there was quite a lot of trading in muskets and gunpowder. And that got to a point where I think the government even introduced legislation prohibiting the sale of those items. But nevertheless, it still went on. And because of the musket wars, Māori, the length and the breadth of New Zealand, basically wanted muskets to protect themselves from those other Maori tribes. So there were a lot of weapons, muskets and the like, hoarded and gunpowder in New Zealand. Sometimes, like Te Kōti, they got their weapons by raiding it and taking it off either the villages that they raided and that had weapons, or they took it off the soldiers that they might have killed or ambushed or something like that, so they were able to acquire weapons that way. For Te Tikawaru, it was quite difficult because many of their weapons started to get old. They started to have to make their own bullets. They didn't get quite to the stage of Huarako where they were firing peach stones, but they had to repair their own weapon systems, and this is why Kimball Bent was so valuable, I think, to Te Tikawaru. But there wasn't, at that stage, free-flowing weapons and ammunition like there had been, say, for the musket wars in the early parts of the New Zealand wars. But weapons had made their way a length and breadth of New Zealand, even for protection and, you know, and hunting, but also then, of course, you would use them for warfare.
Any other questions?
No? I think we've just about exhausted. Interesting, some of those references that Peter mentioned, the very early ones, James Cowan, they were back in 1922.
Yep.
And then, of course, James Belich's research was a little bit more recent, probably 65 years after that, in 1989, I think. Another interesting one I picked up out at the old Ministry of Books and Censor was this little publication called The New Zealand Wars, written by Matthew Reich from Massey University. This is a really superb, it's really a synopsis, a very brief summary of all of the New Zealand Wars from sort of 1845 to 1869. But it goes through and lists all of the different wars, all the different campaigns, if you like, throughout New Zealand. So, you know, if you can get hold of this, I think at $10 or something. I know he's got other copies out there, but if you're interested, this one is a good summary, and then you can fill in the details, certainly with Belich and then some of the earlier writings from Cowan. The interesting thing is, though, where this is coming into the New Zealand curriculum, into the school curriculum, when we did the engineer history a few years ago, we quite deliberately started it off from the 1500s, and the first chapter of 140-odd pages is specifically written about the period 1500 to 1800s, about the Maori as the preeminent military engineer in New Zealand. And we talk about all the different pā and the various structures involved. And that's one aspect, if you want to have a look at that. The other aspect is the one that Peter mentioned, and that was the report by Tom Mould to the British Parliament in 1869. And included in that report, it runs from the Waitara campaign in 1861 right through to when he went back to England. And attached to that are all of these diagrams and drawings and surveys of all of the pā sites from 1863 to 1865. So you started off with the Waikato Delta and Rangiriri right up to, you know, right through Waikato, Taranaki. I think the last one was Wetaroa in Whanganui. So there's an incredible study gone into that, even though a lot of these maps were surveyed and produced back in the 1860s. The other amazing thing to keep in mind is that recorded there were 7,498 pā sites in New Zealand, all hand dug. And if you read about Patarangi from one point to another is 3.5 kilometres of, you know, field defences, solid defences, all dug by hand. Just incredible. But the geometry of them and the strategy put into them is just par excellence. So it's very interesting to get a better understanding for all of us. So I think certainly our next presentation on the 13th of October, Peter's coming back to talk about the musket wars. So that period from sort of the early 1800s, 1807 through to around about 1840, I guess is the period before the New Zealand wars got underway. And then I think next year we're going to focus on a few more of these battles and campaigns, because it's bringing out some really interesting early history. So thanks again for that, Peter. Excellent presentation. All of these presentations are going up on our website online, which you can access. They're fairly available to the public. And also that 1869 report, together with all the maps attached, they're also on our website. So all of that resource is there if you want to make a further study. So without further ado, please join me in thanking Peter once again.